Well, good morning. We're now on our fourth week, our fourth sermon in our Come Let Us Reason Together series. This morning we're going to talk specifically about the existence of God and arguments for the existence of God. And I want you to know that it has been genuinely a privilege to engage in you guys with these ideas and these thoughts. It's a blessing beyond explanation. Just to be able to be a part of the church and thinking together and what it means to think about engaging the culture around us. Okay, so after this week, we're going to start to transition a little bit. I'm going to be done for a while. Good for you, right? But Andrew Espin, Chris von Kauser are going to help me with some of this series over the next few weeks. And we're going to begin to shift over the next couple of weeks toward more of a defense of biblical Christianity. Okay, so these past 4 weeks, or 3 weeks and this week, we've really been dealing more with big ideas, right? That I believe are at the foundation of what the Bible teaches. We're dealing with worldview ideas. So we're going to start to narrow down a little bit. Okay, so just so you're aware where we're going. So this morning, we're gonna wrestle with this idea and thinking on the existence of God together. Okay, so let me pray for us, and then we'll dive in. Our good Father, Lord, it is good to know that you are God from everlasting, that there has never been a time when you have not reigned supreme, that you, in your goodness and your love, and the Trinity of your person have forever been exalted in glory. We thank you, Lord, that we can come together as a family, as children of your kingdom and of your love, and that we can be honest with the things that we wrestle with, and we can think through them, and we can grow together, and that your Spirit is with us and guides us in truth. And so my prayer for this morning, Lord, is that you will allow me to be a blessing. Allow these people to be blessed by the truths that are rooted in your word and the way in which they flow from it and out of the love of Christ and the person of Christ and the house and family of Christ. So bless us this morning. Do our souls good. Be exalted in our midst, in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, so does God exist, right? How many of you have actually wrestled with that question at one point in your life? Give me a show of hands, okay? Actually wrestled with it, okay? So you are the honest people. The people that didn't raise your hands, we know who you are. We were watching, okay? We know that you're afraid to admit it. No, I'm teasing you, right? Okay, it's a perennial issue. People from as long as we have written history, the early Greeks wrestled with this issue of whether or not God or the gods existed. And so today, we want to dive into that a little bit. We want to think on that together, okay? But before we can really do that, we got to lay some groundwork, okay? We got to get some ideas out of the way that will help us think through this issue. And the first of which is what I want to address as what I call the problems of proofs, okay? The problems of proofs. What's a proof? Well, in this instance, I mean it as kind of like an argument, right? An argument for God's existence or for anything, you know, that you're trying to make a point for, okay? Well, we got to think through some of the problems with proving things, okay? Because there are, if you've been paying attention over the past few weeks, you're starting to realize that that is a problem, right? It's difficult when we think through what it means to prove things, especially to other people. Okay, so one of the first things I want to think through, okay, in this problem of proofs is what I call the difference between proving God and proving Bigfoot. Okay, in my philosophy 101 class, my philosophy professor was a militant atheist. Nice guy, kind of, but he seemed angry whenever this issue came up. Okay, and his way of thinking about evidence for God was comparing it to evidence for Bigfoot. Right? There's this creature out there that people are claiming exists, right? This elusive creature that lives out in the woods. But if he really existed, my professor said, we would easily be able to find it out because there should be piles of feces everywhere, right? There should be Bigfoot droppings if we're going to find Bigfoot. And I got to tell you, that's a good point, right? Okay, this is a large creature. Wherever he's at, there should be Bigfoot droppings in that vicinity, right? Okay, and so he compares this to proving the existence of God. Why do we see no evidence for the existence of God? Shouldn't we see evidence for the existence of God? Well, the problem with that line of thought is that it treats God as if he is a creature trapped within his creation, right? That's exactly what we're trying to say, that God is creaturely, and he's like other creatures, and we should be able to see his creatureliness somewhere within this creation. But as Christians and as theists, right, we believe in the existence of God, we are asserting that the God who exists is a God who is transcendent, right? He's above and beyond the creation. He's not trapped within inside of it, right? And so when we talk about evidence for the existence of God, what we mean is not evidence of creatureliness. We mean that the creation should bear the mark of its creator, right? This world, this universe, it should resemble in its form, in its shaping, in its working, in its complexity, in its beauty, in all the ways in which it functions. It should have an imprint on it, right? It should have a fingerprint, a stamp that reveals, that points to the fact that something greater has made all these things. Do you understand the distinction I'm trying to make here? When we talk about evidence for God, we are not going to be able to provide creature evidence, right? Like a snake skin that a snake has shed and left behind, that we can see the evidence of its creatureliness, right? Because that is not how God exists. So even in the realm of science, we talk about the relationship with theory to data, right? Theory and phenomenon. If there's a phenomenon that we don't understand, we put forward a theory with which to explain the phenomenon, right? And if the theory does a good job, it makes sense of it, right? It gives us a grid to understand it. But if the theory has holes, if it doesn't make sense of it, we understand there's a problem here, okay? Everybody taught in school the old belief of that the earth was the center of the universe, right? And that they tried to make sense of what they saw and the patterns and the stars, and it just didn't make sense of everything, right? And then this crazy guy comes along and says, maybe the sun's the center of our solar system, right, at least, or what we see. And all of a sudden, it began to make sense, right? A new theory better explained the data. Okay, well, this is what we are saying, or at least is what I'm trying to say, is that Christianity makes better sense of the world around us. It makes better sense of the human experience. Okay? And that's really what we talked about last week. We were comparing. We were using what's called an inductive argument. We were building the case for Christianity. We weren't offering some kind of definitive proof, right? I wasn't saying, look over here. Here are God bones or God skin or God droppings for that matter, right? Okay? There's no creaturely proof we can point to because God is not trapped with inside this creation. What we are saying is that this creation is a design and it functions as a design. This is what Paul, I believe, is saying in Romans 1. We can look at this world around us and we can say, this is ordered, right? This looks as if it is following a pattern. This looks as if there are laws built into the function of it. This looks as if there is beauty inherent within it. This looks as if there is the stamp of the image of the Creator on the creation in the order of everything that happens. Okay? So, that was last week, right? Everybody got that. Okay, we looked at secularism and Christianity, and we looked at the fact that I sincerely believe that Christianity offers a better explanation, a better pattern, a better understanding of life. It makes sense of the world around us. Okay, so we have the problem of proving God from a creaturely perspective, right? But there's further than that. We can think about the difficulty of proving anything to anybody. Okay, and because of individual standards of belief. Okay, what might be convincing to you might not necessarily be convincing to the next person. And we have a bigger problem when we encounter people who are basically determined not to believe whatever we have to say. Okay, have you, any of you guys ever been in a discussion with someone you love, that you're close to, that you spend a lot of time with, that may be more attractive than you, but you talk a lot with this person, right? Not naming any names, you're pointing any elbows. Okay? But you have found in the course of your discussion that you feel as if this person is determined not to agree with you. And it's really no longer about the facts. It's just that you have two people set from different viewpoints, right? And that's what we talked a lot about that. And I really hope everybody got that concept of the worldview, right? And these ideas that are really at the basis of what we believe, and that they are faith ideas. They're ideas with which we really don't have the power to prove them all. We accept most of them by faith, right? We assume them. And we talked about some of those within the worldview of secularism and within the worldview of Christianity, right? Okay. So we have these problems of people who are determined not to believe, and the problems of what other people consider convincing. I read an article yesterday. I was reading an article about a guy's reason for not believing in God. And he asserted, number one, there is no evidence for the existence of God. And he kind of rattles through the what he believes about this. And at the end of that paragraph, fact, no one has ever given a single iota dot of evidence for the existence of God. Well, you see what the problem is here, now that we've been discussing this whole worldview issue, is his definition of evidence is very different from what we're trying to assert, right? He wants a naturalistic, he wants a creaturely evidence, a point to this evidence. But we can't give that to him, can we, right? Because God is not in his creation. He's not a creature. So he's already set the parameters by which he's going to refuse in anything supernatural. There is no transcendent. He's already determined that he's not going to believe it. Okay, so thinking on that for a second, what are the conditions of belief? And what is the role of experience in that? Okay, what I have found, and maybe you have found this too, and maybe not, okay, is that when you encounter people who have begun to change their opinion on something, or become open to the idea of belief in God or belief in Christianity, most of the time what you encounter is that this person has been shaped by some experience in their life, not necessarily that they have encountered some powerful proof, right? To give you an example, I had mentioned a good friend of mine, I hadn't talked to him in a while, but I still consider him a friend. As I was becoming a Christian, he was drifting towards atheism. And he had become very entrenched in his ideas, and so did I, for that matter. But when he years later I talked to him, he asserted that he had changed his view on that he had actually become now something like an agnostic. He was no longer convinced that God didn't exist. And what happened? Was it some argument that he encountered? Was he thinking on some of the arguments I gave him, and he just realized how smart they were and how great they made sense? No. Okay? No. What happened is that he joined the army and went to Iraq. Okay? And that experience convinced him that he couldn't make sense out of his world in crisis, right? In crisis situations, and surrounded by the potential of death. His worldview no longer was satisfying to him, is what he told me. And he said the old saying is true, that there are no atheists in foxholes. Right? Has anybody ever heard that before? He asserted that that was true, okay? So it was an experience, right? I've heard people say that in their experience being somewhat hardened or just opposed to Christianity, God unwittingly and to no fault of their own injected into our church and into the fellowship of our church, and because of the love and kindness of people in the church, they became open to the idea of believing. Okay, so what is this? Why am I mentioning this? Okay, well, the reason I'm bringing this up is we're going to talk about arguments for the existence of God. And I genuinely hope they will bless you and help you as you think through these issues. But I hope that you do not view these arguments in the sense that you're going to go out and you're going to be, you know, firing from the hip at people and just knocking them down and bringing them to an understanding of what you believe, because you're not. It's not going to happen that way. Okay? If you genuinely want to engage with other people and convince them and bring them closer to Christ, then you are going to have to do it by Christ-like kindness and love and compassion to these people. Okay? You need to become a friend to these people before they will begin to open the door to you, to allow you to speak into their life, and to allow you to begin to... And that's what I hope these are. These arguments are more for moving barriers out of the way in order to speak the gospel into these people's lives. Okay? That's what they are. So what's our goal for this morning? Okay? Well, our goal is, as I've been saying, that my hope for you is that in wrestling through these issues, it will actually strengthen your faith. I believe that to be true, and I hope that you will take that seriously. I hope that you will think on these things, wrestle with these things, because I believe if you do, the Holy Spirit will actually lead you deeper into truth, not further away from truth. And in doing so, it will ground you. It will help you. I think that's good, and I think we need to do that as a group. As a people of God, we need to take that seriously. Okay? But further than that, I hope that you will see that we as Christians have something to offer to the world around us. Right? We have the gospel. We have hope. Right? We talked about that last week. The ideas within secularism leave us without a firm grounding of hope, without a sense of identity. Okay, still wrestling with the problem of guilt. I believe we talked about that a few weeks ago. When it comes to unbelief, I have become convinced that unbelief is rooted not in a lack of knowledge, but in a rejection of knowledge. It's really rooted in this issue of guilt, maybe even at a subconscious level. Okay, now if you told that to an atheist, they would probably think you were insulting them, right? Okay, but I think it's more to do with the need to experience forgiveness than it is knowledge. Okay, so our goal is that you will see that the people around you, you have something to offer them. And if you will engage them and love them, and they will open the door to you to allow you to speak into their life, and you may need to wrestle with one of these issues with them. There may be a barrier to belief in their heart that you need to speak to, but you're not going to have the authority to speak to them until you are kind to them, right? Until you get the opportunity to express compassion toward them. Okay? So that's number one. But I want to think on these things together because I hope that time will come for you. Okay, I hope that you will have a time when you can speak into the life of another person. So we're gonna move forward and talk about some of these issues. Okay, and the first thing that I want to talk about this morning is reasons not to believe. You didn't see that one coming, did you? Okay, reasons not to believe. And the reason I want to talk about this, and I've picked three reasons, which in my experience have been the most common. Okay. The reason I want to bring these up is not because I want to spend a bunch of time giving a defense of these. I want to give them to you because I want you to wrestle with them. I want you to take them seriously because the people you encounter will be struggling with this. Okay? And if you want to speak into their life, you are going to have to struggle with the same things they have struggled with. Right? You're going to have some degree of genuine point of contact with them in which you can speak to them. Okay? You remember that Jesus actually walked in our shoes before he died for us. Right? He actually struggled in the midst of sin and experienced the temptation to sin before he could become a merciful and faithful high priest to whom we can go to in our temptations, right? Okay? Same concept. I want you to think through these things, and I hope that you will actually wrestle with them. Okay, number one is the problem of evil. Anybody ever thought through this before? Heard of this before? The problem of the existence of evil in the world around us. Okay, and I hope that you will consider the emotional force of this argument. Okay, and I don't mean that it's not intellectual. I just mean that it is powerfully emotional when people talk about this as the reason for which they reject the existence of God. We are all, as in this world, seem to be very sensitive to the idea of evil, right? And to the presence of suffering. And so when we see suffering around us, it hits us at a point to where it's intuitive that we look at this and we say, this is wrong, right? There's no argument within our head. We don't have to reason to that point. We see something and we say to ourselves, that is wrong. Has anybody ever had that experience? And we look around the world and we get outside of our little Western culture where we live very comfortably and very happy, and we see people out in the world suffering. Okay? And there's people all around you who see it, and it hurts them, right? They're bothered at the core of their being by it. And then we come along as Christians and we say, there's this all-powerful God who loves you and who has a wonderful plan for your life. And they see the suffering and they hear this about this good, powerful God, and they can't reconcile the two. Right? They can't bring those two ideas together. And I can sympathize with that. I understand that. Okay? For me personally, the problem of evil and the suffering in the world doesn't push me toward unbelief. For me personally. Because I find it strange that we all have this sense, this knowledge of evil, right? We all look and we say, that is wrong. It ought to be this way. Why is it we all have that ingrained in us? It leads me to reason to the fact that there is something greater that tells us that this is wrong, right? We all have that knowledge. Now, not everybody thinks that way. That's not a defense. That's not what I'm trying to say. Okay, but that's just where it leads me. What it does lead me to question is the goodness of God. Okay, it makes me struggle with that. Is God good? Is God a heavenly monster? Right? That's me. Okay. You ever read the book of Job? It's a little scary. Okay. But that's an issue of faith when we come into Christianity, okay? But I want you to think through that. That's what I'm asking you. I'm asking you to take that seriously, that people are wrestling with that. Okay, number two is that the world can be explained without God. The world can be explained without God. Has anybody ever heard of the Enlightenment, right? Raise your hand if you've ever heard of the Enlightenment, okay? Maybe in your high school history class, maybe you had to take a college philosophy class, and you tried to listen, right, for about 3 minutes, and then you zoned out. And so nobody has any idea what the Enlightenment was actually about, right? Okay, you can say it. It's okay. Okay, oddly enough, it's actually really interesting. Okay, and it's not just because I'm weird. It really is. Okay, you just got to get to the right person to explain it to you, why it was interesting. Okay? But one of the things that happened in the Enlightenment, in the early part of the Enlightenment, was that philosophers and scientists and thinkers began to think about understanding the world in its natural phenomenon, right? Understanding the world as it works and moves and what happened was, they didn't really intend it to happen, but a lot of these philosophers began to explain the world without reference to God. Okay, and so philosophy began to move, and science began to move in a way of explaining the world without the need to explain God's involvement in it. Does that make sense? Okay, so it was these ideas that began to move in away from what's called scholasticism, right, and into the Enlightenment. Okay, scientists began to think about the world and philosophers in a way of explaining it as we experience it without reference to the God of the world, okay? And so what happened was, and especially once Charles Darwin came... There we go. Charles Darwin came along, and he introduced this idea, right, which wasn't entirely new, of evolution as a mechanism for how we got from point A to point B. Right, it actually introduced what we would call a creation story. Right, atheism at that point was missing a creation story for which to account for how we got here without a God. Okay, well that's what evolutionary theory did.
It provided a creation story. And now you have a creation story, and now you have the ability to explain why we are the way we are in the world and where we're going. Okay? And this gave the world the ability to explain itself without the existence of God. Okay, so now that's one of the things we encounter today. You might encounter people who say, and I've had this said to me, I don't see the need for God. I can explain the world without reference to God. I don't see the need to inject him into it. Okay? Now, I would just disagree with that. In fact, that's what I talked about for an hour last week, right? Is that secularism and naturalism fail to explain the world in a satisfactory way, right? There's all kinds of holes in the theory. It's missing what I would consider significant explanations for why things are the way they are. Okay, but it's something that people wrestle with, and you're going to have to take that seriously if you're going to engage with them. Okay, number three is really not an argument. It's just the fact that people will assert that you, as a believer in God, are the one required to provide the argument. See what I mean? The burden of proof is on you to prove to me to believe in God. If you can't prove that God exists, I'm just not going to believe in him. Okay? Okay. Well, there's problems with that. Okay? We don't really have to launch into those, but that's just one of the ways in which that you're going to encounter if you're going to talk to people about the existence of God. Okay? The burden of proof is on you. Okay? Well, we talked about Romans 1, right? Which the light of the knowledge of the Creator is in everybody, whether they want to admit it or not. So really, the burden's on you, right? No. Okay. So those are three reasons, common reasons, why people reject the existence of God. Okay? Okay, let's move on, and we're going to talk about, I chose five arguments for the existence of God. I chose these five because they tend to be the five that resonate with me, and I'm the one talking, so I get to pick. Okay? So there are other arguments. Some people find some of them more convincing. That's them, right? Okay, these are the five that tend to resonate with me. They're in no particular order, but we'll talk about them. And I want to give them to you, but I can't launch into the details of all of them. We don't have that kind of time. Okay, nobody wants to sit here until dinner time, right? Okay, so I'm going to give you these arguments. I'm going to give you the gist of the argument, but it's up to you to do the research and think through these arguments and whether or not they make sense to you. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So, number one, the argument from existence. Okay. There's different names for some of these arguments. I would call this a form of the ontological argument, although it's not what's classically the ontological argument. Nobody cares what that term means. Okay? It means existence, from being. Okay? Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? We all know that passage. And there's lots of powerful ideas that come out of that. They just like spill out of it. Okay? Number one is that who was first? God, right? Does it tell us what was before that? It just tells us God, right? All we know is that God was there. And as far as we know, he was always there. And at some point, God decided to create the universe. Okay? So which is greater, we might say? Which is superior? Is God within the creation or is God outside of the creation? Well, he's outside, right? He's above it. Everything that exists comes from him. Okay? But I want you to think about, as we think about this argument, is that what happens if there was a time when there was absolutely nothing? Try and think about that for a second. What if there was ever a point when nothing existed? And I don't mean just empty space, because we know, which blows my mind, right, that space isn't nothing, it's actually something. Right? And somehow time is interwoven into it. Did you know that we have clocks on satellites that actually run slightly faster because time is different here than it is out there? Blows my mind, right? Time is different depending upon its closeness to mass, right? Okay. Which means time is related to space. It's interwoven. They're one and the same thing somehow. Okay. But I'm not talking about that. There's no space, there's no time, there's no nothing. What will we have now? Take a guess.
Nothing.
Okay? If there was ever a time, ever a point when there was nothing, we would have nothing now. Has anybody ever heard anybody say, use the term self-creation or spontaneous creation or spontaneous generation? You ever heard those terms? Those are self-defeating terms, just so you know. They actually logically don't make sense. Okay, for something to create itself, it would have to be in order to bring itself into being. You following me? But if it isn't, then it can't. Okay? There was a time when people believed in spontaneous generation, right? But they figured out that wasn't the case. Okay? So this idea, it's illogical. So the question is, if there is something now, and we can all probably agree on that, we talked about that the other week, right? The problem of minds, of other minds. I know I exist, but I don't know about any of you guys, right? There's something here now, which means something has had to always be there. Something has had to always have been. What was it? Okay? Well, I believe it's reasonable to think that whatever it is has to be greater. It has to be greater than everything, than the sum of everything we have, if it's the origin of all things, okay? Including life and consciousness, right? It has to be greater than that. If the only thing that has ever existed is matter, matter does not produce life as far as we know it. We have never seen organized matter just spontaneously burst into life. Life is something that goes away. It's not something that comes back. Okay, a guy named A.E. Wilder Smith, I read one of his books a long time ago, he made the point that if you take a can of sardines, okay, you got all this organized matter within this can, and yet there's no life. And you can put as much electricity and energy or heat or whatever you want, you can shock the tar out of it, those fish ain't coming back to life. Why is that? Why is it that matter and organized matter can't seem to produce life or consciousness? Okay? Now, according to evolutionary theory, we believe that's the case, right? That's the case, that life comes together and it just happens, right? There's life just popping out of everywhere. But we don't see that. Okay? So I think it's reasonable to conclude that what has always been is greater than all things. It's above all things. Everything that exists, it's bigger, right? It's better. And I believe that is God. Okay? Now, does that lead us to believe in the Christian God? Not necessarily, right? Okay, that's not what we're trying to do here. But it does lead us to think on the fact that something greater has to have always been there. Okay? Now, some people will lead that into the issue of where did God come from, right? Who created God? Well, if we start a chain of events that never ends or never has a beginning, we still have no beginning, right? We still never had a start. Something had to have always been there. Something had to be in itself the beginning. Okay, maybe that resonates with you. Maybe it doesn't. Okay, number two, the argument from design. Okay, the argument from design. Okay, this is the idea that of the watchmaker, right? If we were walking on out in the woods in the middle of nowhere and we came upon a beautiful golden watch and we opened it, we saw its parts, we'd conclude that someone had made this, right? It seems reasonable. Now, some people reject that, but I think if we look at the world around us, what we find is a beautiful design, an organized design. In fact, our world, our universe is so fine-tuned in its running that it's amazing. Okay, the laws of physics, the issues surrounding gravity and the strong and weak nuclear force and all of these things that are so perfectly set up that makes life possible, that it's difficult for me to understand that these things all just happened randomly. These things all just fell into place. We consider the creation around us, right? The human body, the human eye, the fact that a woman can develop a child within her body, right?
We look at the immune system in the human body. We look at the world around us. Just the fact that we live on a planet where water is present in all three states. Did you know that? And as far as we know, as far as the telescope can search the universe, we can't find another one of those. Did you know that our star sits in our galaxy in such a place where we can see outside of our galaxy? If we happen to be more toward the center of our galaxy and we're surrounded by many more stars, it would be almost impossible for us to see further out into the galaxy. But it's almost like we're in the perfect place to look out into the universe. That's kind of weird. Right? I believe this is what Paul was talking about in Romans 1. That people have a knowledge that's God has given them. They have it. But they suppress it. But they have this knowledge that when they look at the created order, they realize, they see that this is too ordered. This is too patterned. This is too beautiful. This is too glorious. And it points to something greater. Okay? It points to something greater. Anybody ever heard of the terms microevolution and macroevolution? Anybody ever heard of those terms? Does anybody understand the difference between those two terms? Okay. In my experience in high school, when I was taught evolutionary theory, I was taught that what's called microevolution was evidence of evolution in the big sense. Okay. Anybody ever see the pictures of the birds and the beaks growing longer and shorter, or the moss that went from being predominantly white to predominantly black and then back again? Anybody ever seen those? Okay. All of those, as fascinating as they are information that is already in that animal, right? It's already built within the genes of that animal. And that information is just changing slightly. That's called microevolution, or what we call adaptation. That is exceptionally different from a bird growing hands with opposable thumbs, right? Or snakes sprouting wings. Or frogs learning how to build machine guns so storks don't eat them, right? We don't see sudden, miraculous introductions of information. Now, obviously, evolutionary theory is arguing that this happens over a long period of time. But as far as we know, when we look at the fossil record, what we find are animals that are either dead and gone, or animals that look relatively close to what we see now. Right? Some are different, but they're pretty close. Anybody ever heard of the concept of the missing link? Anybody ever heard of that before? Raise your hand. Okay? Got to get a little participation in my sermons here. Okay? Why is that even a concept? Okay? If evolution is this slow progress of species transforming into other species over time, we ought to have millions of examples of what we call intermediate species. But instead, what we find in the fossil record is animals that look pretty much like they do now. Or suddenly animals appear in the record that look pretty much like they do now, or we don't have them anymore. They're just gone, right? Instead, what we have are these concepts of missing links, which if you look into them, you find out they're like pieces of a jawbone, right? That somehow they constructed this entire ape man, that scientists debate whether they're the missing link or just an ape or just a man, right? Okay? My point is, I find that interesting that there's even the concept of a missing link. Okay? So when we look at the world around us, what we find is design and function and adaptation, right? But we find these creatures all designed to live within the world and be able to equip to live within the world that they were designed to live in. Okay? That's the argument from design. Number three, the argument from the reality of morals. We can call this the argument from ethics. You can make up whatever you want. I don't care. Okay? Okay. The argument from the reality of morals. As I said earlier, I believe that we all have an intuitive knowledge of evil, right? Is anybody who all was here who was old enough to remember when 9/11, September 11, 2001 happened? Okay? Anybody, lots of people. Okay? What are you raising your hand for? I know you. Okay. Who remembers where they were that day? Remember where you were? powerful moment, right, in history. Okay, I remember exactly where I was, exactly who was, how I heard it, who was on the radio. What interested me at that time was that suddenly lots and lots of people, including the news media and outlets, were using the term evil. And prior to that, I hadn't really heard that in just my experience. And after that, I haven't really heard that very much. Okay? But it was a time of public crises in our culture, and suddenly everyone became aware of the existence of evil. And it was one of those things, we could point to it and we could say, that's evil. We didn't have to argue for it. Nobody had to say, let's reason to how we get to the fact that this is wrong. Okay? We understood. I believe that's probably what happened in World War II when at the end of the war, when the concentration camps were exposed, right, to the world, when people found those. People saw those and they said, that is wrong. That is evil. Okay? We have this idea of ought built into it. It ought to be this way. We ought to act this way. Sometimes we debate about some of the nuances of that, but there's this issue that we ought feel that. There's an oughtness to the world around us about how we should act. And maybe we debate some things, but we don't debate things like well, we do at times, but the issues of human rights, right? People ought to have a right to life, a right not to be killed. Where do we get that idea from? We talked about before, that's not supplied by secularism, right? If evolutionary theory is true, we got here by survival of the fittest, by the strong triumphing over the weak. Doesn't it make sense that that would be ingrained into our society? That we should not nurture the weak, that we should not protect the weak, but instead we should let the weak die because it's better? It's better for us as a whole, as a society, to crush down the weakest people in our presence? Maybe I'm wrong, okay? But the very existence of the fact that we have these ideas of right and wrong, of good and evil, I believe that are real, that are built into us. I don't think they're a result of the evolution of the mind. I think that evil is real. And maybe you totally disagree with that. I think that points to the existence of a God, of a judge of all the earth. Okay? Number four, the argument for meaning. The argument for meaning. Okay. I mentioned Camus last week. I think Albert Camus was a French existentialist philosopher. I think he was French. Doesn't matter. Okay. He said that he believed that human life was an absurdity. Because we all strive in our life for meaning, right? For these, and he particularly placed emphasis on love relationships. But he noticed the fact that it all ends, right? Everyone dies, and death is nothing, right? It is the extinction of human life. It's the end. And he looked at life and he said, "This life ought to be meaningful, but it's not, and it's absurd. It's an absurdity, right?" Well, you notice inherent within that is the question, why ought it to be? Why do we feel like it should have meaning? Why does everyone everywhere feel like life should be meaningful? Why is it when you remove the possibility of significance and meaning from people's lives, it crushes them, right? I was talking about this yesterday with my father-in-law. This idea of, particularly in men, uniting their identity with their work, right? And then when they go to retire, they're suddenly who they are is yanked out of what they thought it was, right? They're no longer work. They're no longer, my meaning is no longer my usefulness at my job. And suddenly they just die, right? It's kind of a crazy phenomenon, particularly among men. When they retire, they just suddenly die. That's horrible, right? But I think it's caught up in this idea of losing significance, right? The losing purpose in life. Okay? Don't intertwine your identity with your work. Just saying. Okay? Maybe this is a little too nuanced. I don't know. But this one, for some reason, strikes a chord with me. I feel, and maybe it's just totally in my head, but I feel like everyone I encounter and myself longs for meaning, longs for identity, longs for significance. And if life is meaningless,
Why is that there? Why is it even there? Well, I think it's there because life is meaningful. Because that's ingrained within us. Eternity is in our hearts. I forget who said that. Okay? It's stamped on us. We realize that death is wrong. There's something wrong with death. Okay?
Number five, the argument from reason. Okay, you may need to put your seatbelt on for this one. Maybe not. Maybe it'll ring true with you. But I think it is a very convincing argument. Okay. We need to start from the worldview of secularism from a second. Okay. Secularism often explains persistence in the belief of God and persistence in religious practice as a result of an evolutionary process that helps us to survive. So it's asking the question, why are people so religious? Well, the answer is, it's just the way we evolved. It's a part. It helped our ancestors survive. It's not really meaningful. It doesn't mean anything that people believe in God or are inherently religious because it's just something that helped them to survive somewhere in the past. Everybody following me to this point? Okay. Well, if we're going to apply that to things like religion and the persistence of belief in God, we also need to apply that to other areas about the human experience, namely consciousness and our reasoning capacity. Right? Where did we develop the ability to think and to reason and about life around us? Okay, how did we come to the point where we are conscious of our surroundings, and we're not only conscious of it, but we're conscious of our consciousness of it, right? Which is bizarre. But we have this ability to seek for truth, to look at things around us and to try to understand the world around us, but not only just to understand it, but to dive into the depths of it, right? But, I've got to turn my head slightly when I use but and P words, right? Okay, but if our mind is a product of evolution, if it's only there because we evolved and it helped us to survive, then we cannot believe at the same time that our mind is somehow an instrument of discovering truth. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm going with this? We cannot trust our mind to tell us truth in the world around us because all it did was it just generated out of nowhere to help us survive. That's the only reason it's there. It's got nothing to do with truth and meaning. Okay, let me try to unfold this just a little bit more. Okay, if naturalism is true, if there's nothing beyond, if all there is the material and the matter in the world, okay, then your thoughts, your consciousness, your mind and your reasoning ability are nothing more than the collision of atoms and the mixture of chemicals and the firing of synapses in your brain. Okay, you're picking up what I'm throwing down here, right? Your thoughts are just atoms slamming together and nothing more. Okay? So if that's true, that your thoughts are just the chance slamming together of things, then how can they be true or false? How can they be meaningful? Anybody ever played pool? Billiards, pool? Okay, when you break, right, and the balls go flying everywhere, do you ever look at that pool table and say, wow, that's meaningful, that's true? No, you don't, because those concepts don't even apply to that. That's not true or false. It's not meaningful. It's just the collision of things, right? And so if reason developed from evolutionary theory and all it is the slamming together of atoms, it has nothing to do with truth and meaning. Okay? And so if reason gives us naturalism and naturalism undermines reasoning, then doesn't that undermine naturalism? I lost a couple people. Totally cool. Okay? Think about that one. All I'm saying is that if your mind developed by chance as an evolutionary process,
It cannot give you truth. It cannot search out truth in the world because that's not what it's for. It's only for survival, right? Truth is an illusion, if that's true. Okay. See the smoke's coming out? Gears are grinding? Okay. Okay. So those are five arguments for the existence of God. Okay? Five arguments for the existence of God. Are they proofs? What do we prove? I think those are convincing arguments. I agree with them. Okay? But not everybody's going to feel that way. That's totally okay. Okay? But the reason I'm giving them to you is because I want you to wrestle with them. I want you to think through them. Okay? I want you to feel the power of them so that you can be prepared to actually engage in discussion with people around you. You can actually talk to people about what they're wrestling with. Okay? Number four, and what I want to close on, our last point here, is reasons to believe in the God of the Bible. Reasons to believe in the God of the Bible. Did any of those arguments point us to Jesus Christ that I just gave? Absolutely not. Okay? But are they significant if someone is struggling with those things? Yes. Okay? Okay. But, and I'm just gonna touch on these because, thank the Lord, these other guys are going to preach these sermons for me so I don't have to deal with them. Okay? Okay. Yeah. The problem of evil. Threw that one to Andrew. Okay? Okay. Real quick. Reasons to believe in the God of the Bible. The life, the words, the claims of the person of Jesus Christ. Okay? Mr. Chris is going to dive into this for us. But as we think on who Jesus is and what he did, it's powerful. It's powerful. Okay? The death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Okay? I said that there is no creaturely evidence for God in the world, right? Because God is not a creature. He's outside of the world. Well, the crazy claim of the Bible is that God actually became a man, right? He actually came into the world, and there's actually an empty tomb somewhere where he was, right? And there's actually things that could be pointed to in this world, which is mind-blowing, okay? But we're going to talk about that. And I think that's powerful. That's actually how I was converted to Christianity. I became convinced of the resurrection of Jesus Christ before I became convinced of anything else, okay? So I'm going to leave that to better minds. Okay, but I want to close on this, okay? This idea of closed doors. Okay, we as Christians have something to offer. The gospel is the good news that God, in his transcendence, in his above-the-worldness, entered into the world, into our experience, identified with us in our life, and took our guilt in his death, and rose to bring new life, right? There is all kinds of people who need to hear that. And they're in your life and they're around you. And you need to engage them. You need to love them so that they will hear your words and you can open up doors, right? You can remove barriers to the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's our goal. Okay, that's our hope. Okay? I hope that some of this has blessed you, that some of this has been meaningful to you. I know it's been different for our members. I know it's been a little weird even, okay? But I believe it's for your good. I genuinely believe it's for the good of our church. So we're gonna have a time of celebration now. We're gonna come together and